Anyway, you're all clear on NP hardness and things like that. If you are, then something's wrong. The other thing I should ask is, has anybody tried to get a Carcimony program and run it on a set of data yet? Usually there's one or two people who tried this early. And did it, in fact, work? Like you could figure out a way to get the file down onto your computer and get Carcimony program. Okay, so nobody's struggling at this point. Since we're coming up on a 3-day weekend and we're therefore not going to have more class before, well, the thing will be due on the Wednesday, so there'll still be one class. If people have struggles, ask me by email. I'll probably, unless the email involves embarrassing personal details of you, I will put it out to the class mailing list with you anonymized and with my response of, here's how you get it to work, you do this, you do that. So use the class email mailing list. Well, the other thing you can do is ask on the class email mailing list yourself. You have a right, if you're a registered student, you have a right to post to it. It'll go out and then I can answer or others of you can answer. Okay, so where we're headed now is to talk a little bit about reconstructing ancestral states. And then I'm going to try to get ahead of, and a little bit about branch lengths. Then I'm going to try to get ahead of our schedule because I think the next bit of our schedule is probably squeezed a bit. So we'll try to deal with that. Okay. So what I want to do is talk about, let's say you've done a parsimony analysis, and you have various sites in it, let's say it's DNA sequences. And for those sites having gotten some tree, you would like to reconstruct ancestral states. Well, if you would do that, if you want to do that, the sort of obvious thing to do is to work site by site. So you have a given tree. We have already, as part of the parsimony analysis, figured out what the smallest number of changes would be for that site. That's part of our getting the score of the tree. In doing that, you worked your way down the tree, and you'll remember that, say, under the Sankoff algorithm, you left behind, little. You had little arrays for that site of all four possibilities and how many steps were needed from that point up on the tree. That was what you used to do the Sankoff algorithm. And so we have those. We're going to make use of those. So it'll just be a matter of, well, you know what the score is already. Let's see if we can somehow work with that to figure out what the actual states were for that site. So we're going site by site, and it's independent from any site. Now, if you look at the bottom, you'll see the array down there. What it meant was, of course, the number of steps given that there is an A here, a C here, a G here, or a T here. And it's the number of steps from that point up on the tree. Well, that includes the entire tree. That's the entire tree. So, trivially, obviously, the most parsimonious assignment of bases would include either an A or a G. Those are tied for each other there. So at the bottom, it's trivial. You can do that. Now, you recall that the way the Sankoff algorithm worked was that when you were down here, you were trying to figure out what these numbers were. What you did is you had two immediate descendants. Here's one of them, and there's another one up this way. And for each of those, what you may recall, the Sankoff algorithm worked by saying, well, this is a, let's say, a C. What's the number of steps you need on the left side here? Well, it's, you consider the possibility that the immediate descendant is A, C, G, or T.
And for A, you say, well, it's the cost of changing to A plus however many steps are needed from that point up, given that it was an A. This cost here might be zero, doesn't have to be, but might be, plus whatever's there, etc. And you've computed these four quantities and picked the smallest one or ones of those, and that was the contribution that the left side made to this stuff. Okay, so if we say, well, let's assume that it's a C down here, what is, which assignment of states up here would give you the smallest parsimony score? Well, it'll be whichever one has the smallest of these four quantities. Okay, and if this isn't 100% totally clear, please harass me about it, because there will be others of you. Okay, and then we can do the same thing on the other side. So given that there's a C down here, we could work out what state should be over here and over there. Now notice, that's given that it's this state. So let me show you a diagram as to what happens if you do that for this particular site on this particular tree with those weights of changes of, you know, that was this weighted parsimony where you had more penalty for going from a purine to a pyrimidine or pyrimidine to a purine than staying within those categories. So we had 6, 6, 7, 8 down here. If we started with an A, our best assignment will be to have zero changes and 2.5 up here, also an A. If we start with, and if we go this way, our best assignment is this one, also an A, no change plus also an A. If it starts out with a C, our best assignment is shown by the arrow, no change plus 2.5, no change plus 3.5 over there. So these, you can imagine yourself drawing arrows on this diagram to say how any choice down here is reflected in the most parsimonious assignments further on up the tree. And it all comes by just using those pieces of the calculation you did in the Sankoff algorithm. Out in the computer, what you're doing, you've come down the tree filling out these arrays. If you just leave them in computer memory while you're doing your analysis, come up with the score for the tree. After that, if you wish to go back, then you have these and you can just use them to decide what the consequence is. But the consequences are not just a simple assignment, because if I look at one reconstruction, say, well, we could have an A here, and then that means an A there and an A there. We just basically follow these arrows. From here, well, it has to change to a C, and this has to stay an A, and so on. This stays an A, and that stays an A. And then the tree that you're getting, the assignment of ancestral states, is, I'll draw it over here. So basically, you have the tree, you have C, A, C, A, G. If we start out with an A down there, then this is an A, those are fixed, this is an A, and that's an A. So it's all A's. Okay, so there is one most parsimonious assignment of ancestral states. As you would get out of the algorithm of looking at the immediate descendants, and I'm putting arrows here to indicate how an assignment here leads to an assignment up there, and there would be some similar bookkeeping in the computer. But if you go and look at the other possible choice down at the bottom, that's a C, then you're going to say, well, it'll be a C. On the left side, again, a C. On the right side, again, a C. So it looks like you're just filling in C's, but not quite, because this
And this one here, when you come to this one, there's some ambiguity because you get a tie. One possibility is to go to an A, and these are AG. But the other possibility, well, I left myself enough room here, would be an A to go to a G, and then an AG. Let me rewrite that. So you'll see now that there's an ambiguity in the most parsimonious assignment of either an A or a G here, but over here, if you, the consequence of choosing an A down lower is that it has to be an A. Okay. So I guess the short answer here is just that there is an algorithm. It comes right out of the most parsimonious assignment. You can use these leftover arrays that are inside the computer. Again, if you're using any of the present-day computer programs, this is all done inside the program. You don't have to worry about it. But it's being done site by site. But the other important thing to realize is that it's the most parsimonious assignment. That doesn't mean the true assignment. The thing about a most parsimonious assignment is the assignment with the smallest amount of penalized total change. And that is maybe more likely to be the correct assignment. Although we'll see when we come to likelihood in Bayesian methods that you can formalize more likely there but in a way that you can't here. But there's nothing that says that it must be this way. There's nothing to say that your view back millions of years into what these molecules are doing is somehow telling you exactly what happened. It's just telling you the most parsimonious scenario. But the question of, well, does that mean that a series of events that would have a bit more penalized change, is it possible that it couldn't have happened? No, it's not saying that at all. It's the inference is fuzzy, and when we go to doing it statistically, it will be statistically fuzzy, and so you'll have some uncertainty. I have to say that the popular science press puts a lot of pressure on scientists when talking about past events in evolution to speak as if they have tremendous precision, that we know that this site was a G, 13.6 million years ago. Of course we know nothing of the sort. We just think it's a bit more likely that it was a G, but you can't tell that to a science reporter. Or if you do, that will be ignored. The plus or minus always gets dropped out. Scientists now know that, that's just ranting and raving. You may freely ignore it, although next time you have to deal with the popular science press, you'll discover to your horror that any statements about evolution you make are being taken as if they represented exact knowledge. Okay, so this will also give you the sense that, first of all, there are uncertainties, there are ties here. But it isn't just that there are ties at individual places, they interact with each other. And for example, you can have situations very easily where there's an A or a G here and there's an A or a G there, but they depend on each other. So you can't do an A here and a G there, then it's not most parsimonious. They interact. Okay.
Can you say that one more time?
I can, but will it help? If it was unclear the first time. if you're doing it by a method like, say, parsimony, although the same issues come up when you're dealing with likelihood or Bayesian inferences, if you go over into a part of the tree and you say, well, I think it was an A there, or there's a top there, or there's a tie there, it could have been an A or it could have been a G. Then you go over to somewhere in the mammals. You go over into the birds somewhere. Oh, look, in that place also this site could have been either an A or a G. Well, sometimes those will be independent statements and all four combinations will be equally parsimonious. But sometimes not, particularly if they're anywhere near each other on the tree. It could be that an A here goes with an A there, and putting a G there wouldn't be a most parsimonious combination. So what you're really inferring in the ancestral inference is not a, that each point making a separate independent estimate, it's that the set of that the whole bunch of stuff that you reconstruct is a reconstruction, and there can be these interactions. Yeah, please.
So that's a that's another weighting besides just the total score for that particular branch set.
Can you say that again?
So you said like A and G would be equal. They have equal probability.
You might have a case where they would.
But
yeah.
Then combining down below, like in the set below it, is the probability of each still equal, or is it? Is that something?
Usually, in a case here, A and G are equal.
Yep.
But not down here.
Okay.
Down there, why? Because of what's out here, A is more parsimonious.
So more basal notes will provide more information about.
Yeah, and that these choices here, now in this case, it's just, in this case, it looks as if it's just responding to what's up here. Okay, but over here, take a look. This is either A or C. Now up there is either A or C, and you say, so that's not not a good example. What am I thinking of? A, C, G. Yeah, let's look here. Here's a good example. This could be a C or it could be an A. Now up above is C, A, and G. You might say, well, why isn't G in there too? And the answer, I mean, if A is plausible here, you'd think by symmetry that G should be plausible too. But it isn't, and the reason it isn't is because of what's out here, which are C's and A's, but no G's. So it's because it's most parsimonious in the, you know, in the total framework, as a result of the whole set of data. You know, you cannot just take a subset of the tree, throw away the rest of your data, and work out which was the most parsimonious ancestral state from that, because it won't necessarily be most parsimonious because it has to fit the other stuff too.
But then all trees are subsets of the greater tree, so is anything about it?
Yes, but fortunately you have no information about this locus and all those other. If you did, and you said, I've got cytochrome C throughout all of the eukaryotes, I want the most parsimonious ancestral assignment for, some early lungfish or something. What do I do? The answer, in principle, is use all of that data. And throwing out any of it could, in principle, change it. Now, of course, if I go throwing out snakes, and then I go off into the sparrows, and I say, I want to know about the ancestral sparrow, probably most of that throwing out won't hurt it. Probably. But you know, there are little cases where, you know, even a rearrangement over in the sparrows has a ripple effect and flip when you're nearly tied and flips assignments quite a distance away, but in most cases not. Yeah.
So then, I mean, we might get to this later, but and it's a little more abstract, but then how do you decide, along the same lines, how do you decide when your data set is complete enough to draw valid inferences from, and yet how do you decide when it is valid to exclude things that may end up changing some states for them you don't really care about? How do you decide what to include, given that you are inferring things about the entire set of data and they influence each other?
Well, I mean, if you've got it all and you can do it in the computer, why not? You know, that's one statement. The other is, it really is largely true that your inferences within the sparrows won't depend too much on the jellyfish. That's very rare that there would be. If you want to give, though, hedge your bets a little, you could include like one jellyfish, because probably that has, you know, any effect that anything happening in the jellyfish has, probably that's going to give you most of it. But when you're submitting your paper to PNAS, you may not quote me on that. You may have, I was told I didn't have to, you know. In principle, these long-range effects can happen. Now, when they happen, it usually means things are very nearly tied, and it also means that the difference probably doesn't actually... you don't have a lot of statistical information to tell the difference between those. Yeah?
Some kind of bootstrapping where you remove species.
Well, we're getting to bootstrapping in a couple of weeks, so you're ahead of the game. But you can do some kind of... Their methods have been proposed for adding and dropping species, but they can't, they actually cannot be made rigorously statistical. Methods have been proposed for adding and dropping characters. That's the standard use for resampling methods in phylogenies. But when you resample by adding and dropping species, you're on shaky statistical ground. You can do it, but telling people what it means gets harder. And that is because species, the theory of these resampling methods is based on having independent, identically distributed things. And the one thing you know about phylogenies is the species aren't independent, identically distributed. The whole point of a phylogeny is a diagram of how they're not independent. So they already violate some of the most fundamental assumptions of statistical resampling methods. We'll be getting, you know, we'll be getting there. Okay, so you can make ancestral assignments. They don't have massive meaning. They aren't very certain assignments. The further away from your data you get back into the past, of course, the fuzzier they are. Let's see. Yeah, this just shows some of the one assignment and the other assignment. Okay. Now, I just wanted to give a simple example showing you there can be many, many tied reconstructions. And the way I did that was consider 0-1 parsimony, and I made this unrooted tree here, and I made the branches nice and fat so we could shade them in. And if you have a character that's where these are all 0 and these are all 1s, it's a very symmetrical case, then you're going to have a lot of ambiguity. Now, people might jump up and say, oh, well, wait a second. If that's the way the character is, why did you make that topology? It doesn't fit that character very well. And the answer would be because of all the other characters. Maybe all the other characters are really nailing that phylogeny down. But you've got this one that just fits horribly. And it's going to give you multiple reconstructions. Well, it turns out that you can do this with 6 changes. And here's an assignment, and I'm drawing a little boundary here and here and here and here and here, and those are the 6. Okay. And we shade in, and that's the most parsimonious assignment. However, it turns out that I can also move this boundary to here, and let's see if I get this right, and then revert to state 1 there, and not have this change here. There it is. And that also is 6 changes, exactly tied. And we can keep doing that. We keep moving one over here and here and here. Finally, you get the sort of mirror image of this thing up over here with, again, 6 changes. So those will be a case where there's ambiguity of parsimony, and somebody might jump up and say, ha, this is very interesting, because in this case you're uncertain. And I'd say, no, you're uncertain in all the other cases too. This just shows a perfect tie, and thus forces you to be to acknowledge the uncertainty, but really it applies in all the cases where we can only make one reconstruction. That doesn't mean, as I keep repeating myself, it doesn't mean it's really known. Okay.
Now, I just wanted also to make a comment about branch lengths. We'll be using a lot in the course of, we'll be making a lot of statements about branch lengths, which are reflections either of drawing the tree in time, they're either time, or they're some sort of indication of how much is expected to happen on that branch. Now, you have to watch the wording. I said it's expected to. It doesn't mean how much actually happened. But in the case of parsimony, the most we can do is say, well, taking the most parsimonious reconstructions, how much change happened on this branch? And a convention is, well, you take all your most parsimonious reconstructions and you average them. But it's just something, that's just a thing people thought up to do. It doesn't have any formal theory behind it. But if I do that here, if I say take each branch here and say, well, there's six different reconstructions. In one of them it changed. In the others it didn't change. So there is 1/6 of a change there. We can do that on all the branches. And it turns out for that case, this is what we get. We get branches of length 0, which I'm drawing here as if they weren't of length 0. I just want you to see that they're there. They never change on any of the reconstructions. These branches here, let's see, here, 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 and here are 1/6. So is that one, and so is that one. This branch is actually never changes on that reconstruction. Again, it might be here in the tree just because all the other characters demand its presence and they have some changes. And then you'll see as you go out in these branches, they're getting longer and longer. They're at least showing you more change. Don't overinterpret this though. It isn't a precise indication of how much change really happened. It's the average of the number of changes that occurred among the most parsimonious reconstructions. And there's algorithms, which I'm not going to get into, for figuring this out. And they're Sankoff-like algorithms for coming up with those numbers if you really need them. Again, in modern programs, that is done for you. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say about ancestral reconstruction in a parsimony framework. And what I want to do now is get a little ahead of the schedule and go to the issue of other kinds of parsimony. And those get interesting because they reflect different biological assumptions. And people in the 1960s and early 70s, people fussed a lot about these, and then they kind of forgot the issue. So there's a literature, but it's mostly way back there. Now I just have to get to another projection, which is next week's projection, because I'm ahead of the schedule and I haven't revised it yet, but these figures won't change. So what I want to do is talk about some other kinds of parsimony. Now, the Sankoff algorithm has tremendous flexibility, and you can fill in the table of weights of changes from state to state in various ways. And it will be able to handle almost all of these. Maybe not everything I say, but most of what I'm saying can be handled by messing with the Sankoff algorithm. One of the very, very first kinds of parsimony that was invented was Kamen Sokol parsimony. And Kamen and Sokol, in their 1965 paper, which was the first big parsimony paper with discrete character data that people read, it was in Evolution in 1965, they used a parsimony scheme in which instead of having two states and you could go back and forth between them, you could only go one way. So there's an ancestral state that you can change to a derived state, but you aren't allowed ever to come back. Now you might think, well, is that reasonable? And maybe for some morphological characters, not necessarily. But there certainly are some genomic changes that will work this way. And one of them would be a big deletion of a chunk of DNA could knock out a whole gene, throw it away, and going back and just sticking the gene back in, except by some sort of horizontal gene transfer mechanism,
is not going to be easy to
imagine. So in that case, you might say, okay, I've got my deletion data. I know that my associate Mary Kuhner is working on cancer cells that are evolving and have a tree-like genealogy, and they drop out big chunks of their data. So this kind of parsimony is very, very relevant. And in this, actually, zero would be the presence of the gene, and one would be the absence of the gene. So you have to watch out for that. But if you then say, okay, I want to do that as my parsimony. Here's a tree. Somebody gave me this tree. Here's the tips with their phenotypic states. What do we do? How do we count the number of states? You can do it in the Sankoff algorithm, but it's actually, for this case, it's a lot easier. All you have to consider is that the ancestor of a zero must be a zero. It can't be a one, because you can't change from a one to a zero. So whatever you have, like a one, if you have a point in the tree, and there's some ones descended from it, and some zeros, then it must be zero. And you just go down the tree quickly and fill that in. So zero here, there's a zero above here, there's a zero above there. Now up at this branch here, there are no zeros above it, they're just one, so that's a one, the most parsimonious assignment. So it's actually tremendously easy to go down the tree node by node and fill in what the ancestral nodes may be, and every time you have a branch that has a zero at one end and a one at the other, there's a change, and so you just count those. So it's actually algorithmically easier than Fitch, easier than Sankoff. It was the first one people did, and it was dead easy. So this tree then has four changes. So, and then you just do parsimony, and you might say, well, how do you rearrange the tree? And the answer is the same way you do it in all the others. How do you search tree space? Same way, you know. Everything else is the same. But what we're doing is just using a different biology. So it's got different biological assumptions built in. What's coming in here is, in addition to all the algorithmics, some actual biology is sneaking back in. Okay, that's one kind of parsimony. Here's another one that's interesting. There was a Belgian paleontologist of the late 1800s, Louis Dalo, who never heard of using a computer. He never heard of a computer, let alone using it for phylogeny. He didn't invent numerical algorithms. He was, in fact, most known for his work in a Belgian coal mine. There turned up to be a huge trove of well-preserved skeletons of Allosaurus. Allosaurus is this, it was one of the big meat-eating dinosaurs, a little bit smaller than Tyrannosaurus. In fact, the Burke Museum has what I think is a cast of an Allosaurus, so you can go up there and look at it. Louis Dalo got this famous for work on Allosaurus, but somewhere in his writings on evolution, he said, well, a large complicated character complex, once lost, cannot be re-evolved exactly the same. And that's an insight that's often true. So people tried to make a parsimony method in the 1960s that reflected that. And what they did is to say, well, let's imagine a character that has two states, zero is the ancestral state, one is the large complicated state. We can evolve it once, but it's going to be very hard to imagine it evolving many times forward. But easy to imagine it getting lost. It's easier to say, you know, we in modern terms we'd say to pick up mutations and inactivate genes and mess up the developmental biology. So they wanted a parsimony method that allowed forward change, but only once in the tree, and then explained everything else by multiple losses. So what you do here is you look at the tree. This is the same tree and the same zeros and ones. And you say, okay, now what we're going to say is, since a one is only allowed to evolve once,
if you have a node in the tree and it has a one descendant from it, has some ones and some zeros descended from it, we call it a one. Or if it has only ones descended from it, we call it a one. And we go down and we fill in everything. These are all filled in by ones until we get down here. Now this one does not have to be a one because there's no ones further out. The original change to a one could have occurred here. So then you say, okay, the algorithmics of doing that, by the way, you can do it by putting large weights in the right way into the Sankoff algorithm, or you can do some sort of special case messing about. I'm not going to go into the description of how you do that, but you can decide that this is a one, but down here is not a one, even though there are ones and zeros descended from it, because it doesn't need to be a one. There's no ones further out on the tree. So, in fact, the Dalla parsimony algorithm, to do it properly, you have to come passing down the tree and then go back up the tree in second pass. But anyway, you can end up with this assignment. And up in here, the zeros, in this case, they're all occurring at the last minute. There are three changes. And basically, that is a common Sokal parsimony backwards, because you're basically saying that you're not within this part of the tree. You're not allowed to go from 0 to 1. You're only allowed to go from 1 to 0. What this tries to do is minimize the total number of changes. But it's a much more stringent minimization on going forward than in going backwards. And people have tried to use this, for example, something that people don't concern themselves much with anymore, but patterns of restriction site, restriction enzyme binding sites in genomes might work this way. It could also work in something like a family of transposons, a transposable element being in a certain position. You'd want it to come into that position once and then have a whole bunch of ways of obliterating it. Obliterating it would be easy, much easier than having it come in. That's probably a bad example because transposons do jump around, so I shouldn't have used that as an example. But there are molecular situations where you might want to use this. They're usually in a situation where you don't want to assume a lot of change, but one direction is much, much easier than the other for biological reasons. Okay. Now we get into even weirder, polymorphism parsimony. This was popular briefly in the late 60s. And basically, they said, let's assume that there's zero states and one states, but there's also a state of polymorphism where a species has both states. But let's assume that polymorphism condition is easily lost. So you could start with state zero, have the polymorphism arise by having some ones come into the population without the zeros having been lost. And then after that, it's rather easy to lose one state and go to one or the other state and go to zero. I won't go over any of the algorithms here, but to say that in this case, what you end up having to do is reconstruct 0-1 states at the interior nodes. And the interesting thing is what you end up penalizing. You end up penalizing retention of polymorphism, not change, but lack of change. You actually can do it with the Sankoff algorithm. You have to put stuff on there. You have to put penalties on the diagonal, and then you can do this. So what this will try to do is reconstruct stretches of polymorphism connecting the species that have zeros and ones, although it'll have the polymorphism arising at a certain point. So it's another one. So there are these different methods. Now, that's most of the ones I know about. Let's see. But people have also dealt with
That's for zeros and ones. When you have more states, it was popular in the 60s and early 70s to consider what would happen if you had, say, a morphological character that had multiple states that were related to each other, so that there's a state 0, there's a state minus 1, there's a state 1. Let's say we somehow know that from state 1 you can get to state 2 and to state 3, and from 2 you can get to a state called 4. Okay. Those are some sort of, say, morphological, morphology of an organ or something like that. And then people started saying, well, you know, why don't we imagine that those states are connected themselves in a diagram that is not a phylogeny, but it's what used to be called a character state tree. It's a diagram of which states are adjacent to each other in terms of changing from one to another. You can do that. You can you can then say, I'd like to work out the most parsimonious assignment of changes, the most parsimonious changes given this connectivity of these states. And somebody might say, oh, that's going to be difficult. People have written computer programs to do that. But there's an easier way. And the easier way is something is called non-additive binary coding. The non-additive part is for historical reasons. And that is to say, okay, instead of thinking of this diagram and all these states, let's think of the arrows. And let's just ask ourselves, for each species, for each one of these states that might occur in the species, which end of each arrow it's on. Here's an arrow B. It represents a change between state 0 and state 1. I think we're going back now to the case where say you could change in either direction. Let's say for the sake of discussion. State 1 has the property that it and all of these states here are at this end of this arrow. All of these states connect to the other end of arrow B. So what people have done is to take the original states and this tree, this diagram of connectivity of states, and then say, okay, let's make up new columns, one for each arrow in this diagram, A, B, C, D, E, A, B, C, D, E. Minus 1 will be at this end of the A arrow, and everybody else is at the other end. So we make a 1 for the minus 1 state and a zeros for the other. We call for each arrow, we're basically going to call one end 1 and one end 0. And we have a column for each arrow, and when you fill those in, you get this set of binary states. Now, I hope people can see, I haven't described it very clearly, but I hope people can see sort of how that was done. That it's a set of now 0-1 characters that reflects where each state is on this diagram. And it turns out that if you want to do parsimony and you want to use this connectivity, all you have to do is translate it into these new binary characters and then just do ordinary 0-1 parsimony on them. That as you move, as the species moves from state 1 to state 2, column C will change from 0 to 1, but the others won't change, and that will be one step. Yeah. I need to be asked questions on this, for sure.
Can you give an example again of how this would be used?
Well, not an easy, simple example, no. you'd have to assume that what these are is not a count of something, but they're a morphology. I do know of some wonderful work done on morphology of reproductive organs in Drosophila, where
on the evolutionary tree, there were little sort of camera-elucided drawings of the shape of the seminal receptacle or something like that. And they turned out to have a discrete set of possible shapes. And then you might look at those and say, I think you could change from this shape to that shape rather easily, but not so easily among these others. And you might end up putting your little camera-elucided drawings down and saying, well, it looks like the morphology encourages us to think that the changes that are possible are reflected by this character state tree, which I emphasize, not a phylogeny. It's a diagram of how easy or hard is it to get from one morphology to another.
Okay.
So, I should have made this a bit firmer by having an example like that.
Yeah.
It's not something, by the way, if you say, how widely used is this? The answer is not. How widely ought it be used? Maybe. You know, I don't think it should be forgotten. Yeah.
So you have no actual starting point. I mean, in this case, zero is like kind of the starting point because everything's coming out.
Well,
you
could imagine cases in which you somehow think you know that zero is the ancestral condition. But you could also imagine cases where you don't know that. And these might be, for example, they might be morphologies. They might also be a sequence of behavioral events, a courtship ritual. First it bobs this way, and then it does that, and then it runs around in a circle, you know. And you write down your courtship rituals that you've actually observed and say, well, this one you could get from that one by just leaving out this step or by doubling that other step. And then you might end up with a diagram like this. So it isn't just morphology, it might also be things like behavioral sequences. I'm sorry, I lost your question, but you were asking about rootedness, and
yeah, but
think the answer is...
You can get that from the binary code, right?
If you knew zero was the root, and if you thought you wanted to have Kamen-Sokal type parsimony where it can go one way but can't go back the other, mm-hmm. all you have to do is make the proper characters be Kamen-Sokal and not allow the individual states here to change. It would even allow you to do things like say, well, this arrow I think is unidirectional, but the others are bidirectional. Then you would have a parsimony where the B column was Kamen-Sokal and everybody else is symmetrical parsimony, or sometimes called Wagner parsimony for bad historical reasons. We're almost out of time. I'm not going to go over this paradoxy thing. Where I'm headed is to talk about character weighting. We've been assuming that a change is to be counted as a certain amount, no matter where it occurs in the tree and no matter how many of them there are. But people have thought about the issue of differentially penalizing steps depending upon how many other steps there are in that character. And there are good biological reasons for considering that when you're thinking in terms of parsimony. So we'll start there next time. Meanwhile, go out, I'll suggest two things. Go out there, get programs and run them. Go on, when things don't work, get on email, and we'll find out more. The other is that Monday is Martin Luther King holiday, and I have a link in our syllabus for those who want to know not just about the person, but who want to know what the civil rights movement was like for the people who did it in the South in the 1960s, which I remember, I wasn't there, but I remember vividly. There is a link I put there to a site called Civil Rights Movement Veterans, which is basically people's recollections and reports to each other at the times, and it is quite fascinating reading. So it had nothing to do with this course, but it has to do with the holiday. I recommend that link. You will not be tested on it, however. Okay. So we're going to go into weighting, and then where we're headed also is statistical properties of parsimony methods.